Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in Boston, Massachusetts, and earned a medical degree from Harvard University. A practicing pulmonary physician, he is a past chairman of the American Board of Internal Medicine. Today, he's the executive vice president of the Henry Ford Health System and the CEO of the Henry Ford Medical Group, and as such, leads 1,200 physicians. He's known as the good doctor, Dr. Mark Kelly. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760, WJR.
Now back to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're with the CEO of the Henry Ford Medical Group, the good doctor, Dr. Mark Kelly. Doctor, welcome, an honor to have you.
Thanks, Jack. Pleasure to be here.
Can you start by telling us about your childhood and your mom and your dad?
Well, I have an unusual background in that regard. I'm originally from Boston. My parents were both born and raised there. And my dad was a Navy man, and he graduated from the United States Naval Academy, and so eventually became a Navy pilot. So as a child, we lived all over the country. That was pretty unusual in that era. My dad spanned a tail end of World War II coming out of Annapolis, and then eventually became a pilot and fought in Korea. So we moved from Naval Air Station to Naval Air Station and so on. And we eventually settled down in Washington, D.C. My dad became very interested in the engineering aspect of aviation, particularly electronics, which we take for granted right now. And so he, on the way to D.C., he got a Ph.D. from MIT while he was still a fighter pilot, basically. And so we moved to Washington expecting, as usually happens in the military, to spend about 3 years there. That's the usual tour of duty. But he was pulled and deployed into this new adventure called putting a man on the moon. At the time that John F. Kennedy declared to do that, there were very few engineers, science and electronics engineers, who had pilot experience. So my dad was pulled in to NASA to work on that. Actually, was an astronaut candidate at one time, but he was too tall. He was 6'1", which doesn't seem tall by these standards today, but that was too tall for the Mercury 7. And one of his Annapolis classmates, Wally Schirra, actually was one of the seven. So he became very interested in the scientific development of NASA. And the reason that I'm bringing that up is we spent an unusually long time in Washington, D.C., 8 years. So I spent a good part of my growing up there, although I moved about, about 7 or 8 times before we got to Washington. So I'm from a military family, and so we had an interesting time during my childhood.
Dr. Kelly, what's the biggest thing you learned from your mom, and what's the biggest thing you learned from your dad?
Well, they're both very, very similar, personalities in a good sense. I think my dad's sense, he was a very smart man, but very practical. He said you get along in this life with, he said the Kellys are pretty smart, but most of the success we have is by hard work. So he taught me the value of hard work and to be flexible. He, being a test pilot, he had a philosophic view of life that, you know, life is full of good things and bad things, and you have to do your best every day. My mom, being a Navy wife, was pretty unusual at that time. Most of the experience in the military for people in World War II prior to their experience was men went off to war. They were mostly men at that time. But the Navy wives moved around, so unlike most of the friends she grew up with in Boston, she was moving from place to place. So again, very flexible, very open, learned to, as military kids often do, to be self-sufficient. You're always going to a new school every few years, so that's kind of an interesting experience. And they're good values people. We had a very harmonious situation in our family. I have two brothers, two younger brothers, and we had a very happy childhood, despite the fact that we moved around a lot.
Your dad, a Navy pilot, engineer interest. How was it you decided to become a doctor?
It's an interesting question. I probably would have gone in the Navy and become a pilot like my dad, but at the time that this happened, this was in the 60s, in order to go to Annapolis, you had to have perfect vision. You couldn't wear glasses, and I wore glasses at that time, so that disqualified you. So putting that aside, I went to Harvard undergrad, and at the time was caught up in the science end of things. As I said, the rush to the man on the moon put a lot of high school students in science curricula. I kind of rebelled from that originally and drifted around a bit in the curriculum and eventually liked biology. So I was a bio major in college and at one time thought about being a marine biologist. Anyway, I finally concluded that my love of science and my like of people, really were best fit by going to medical school. I was not destined to be a doctor from, you know, being a child. I kind of decided that that was the best use of the things I was interested in. I like people. I always want to be around people. And I like science a lot. So science and engagement with people is really what medicine is all about. So that's what really drove my interest in medicine.
You and Gail spent 27 glorious years in Philly, Philadelphia. Talk to us about that chapter of your life.
Well, my wife and I met in Boston. She went to school in Boston, as I did. And I did my postgraduate training after medical school at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. And at the time, I thought I would be there a few years and probably go back to Boston where I'd gone to medical school. So we were married and down there, and we liked it. We did everything that you do in a new city because we figured we were leaving. We saw the Liberty Bell and things like that. Well, one thing led to another. I was fortunate enough to be offered opportunities at key times during my career to move up the ladder in terms of ascendancy. And Philadelphia at that time was an emerging city. It was around the time of the bicentennial, so Philadelphia was gearing up. It actually had some problems when we first got there, and it became a wonderful place to live, very, very nice suburbs, excellent schools. So it was a good place to raise children, and Penn is a wonderful place. We really enjoyed it and made some very good friends there. So it was a good time, and it still is a great place to live and work.
We're talking to Dr. Mark Kelly, and when we come back, we'll ask him how it was they came to Detroit. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Once again, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
Welcome back. We're with the doctor known as the Good Doctor on the Paul W. Smith Show every week, Dr. Mark Kelly. Doctor, how was it you and Gail and your family decided to come to Detroit?
Well, I was content at the University of Pennsylvania, and I got this call to look at my current job, which is the CEO of the Henry Ford Medical Group. And initially, because I was quite content at Penn and in Philadelphia, I said no. I never had any experience with the Midwest. Not that there's anything wrong with the Midwest, but we were pretty happy where we were. I could see a fairly long future in that area. So that was a call that came from a recruiter. And then the next call I got was from Gail Warden, who was the CEO of the Henry Ford Health System at the time, who was and still is an icon in American healthcare. And it's kind of like Moses calling you. You know, you have to answer that call. So Gail and John Popovich, who's the chair of medicine, who's a friend of mine, was a friend then before I came here, said they were flying into Philadelphia and they're going to take me to a very, very nice restaurant in Philadelphia to talk to me about this job. So I figured, well, free dinner with Gail Warden and John Popovich, what could be bad with that? So I didn't realize at the time this was kind of a job interview because Gail and I had never met. And just as an aside, I knew more about Detroit and about Henry Ford than probably the average person did. One of my good friends who was chief resident with me at Penn is Dr. Michael Gehabe, who's the CEO of the Oakwood Hospital in the Oakwood system. And Mike and I have been buddies for a long time, and Mike's from Detroit, actually was at Wayne State for a long time. And so I had visited Wayne State as his guest in the past, and Mike also had raised his family for a number of years here in the Detroit region. So we kind of knew from a personal sense how nice this area is. So that was a good sell. And then on the other side of the ledger, I had actually visited Henry Ford in the early 90s. At Penn, we were evolving some strategies to respond to the then Clinton health plan. And I knew that Henry Ford had done a very good job of building a system, so myself and a couple of colleagues came here and studied the system. John Popovich actually helped us in that particular trip. So I knew a little more about the system, as I said, than the average person. So that kind of intrigued me. Anyway, we had the dinner, and so Mr. Warden said, well, would you be interested? And I said, I guess so. I guess I can come visit. I've visited before. It's not a long plane ride. So next thing I know, I'm here to look at the job. And fast forwarding, it was a very good opportunity. It has worked out even better than I anticipated. A great system, doing many, many good things. Not only a system that has done the right thing for its patients consistently, including the uncompensated care that the system has provided then and now, but also as a very academic organization like the one that I had been in at Penn. So the more I looked at the job, the more appealing it was. In terms of Detroit itself, my wife and I visited, we saw a city that needed to change its portfolio in terms of its business and even its aspirations. And we had been through that before, actually. As I said, my wife and I had both been educated in Boston. And my kids don't believe this. My kids were both educated in Boston. But Boston in the 60s and 70s, when we were in school there, was a wreck. Wouldn't believe it looking at Boston now, but it was. And Philadelphia, we got there in the mid-70s, was also a wreck. And it's a great city now. Now, it's taken 20 years in each case to get those cities rebuilt in the fashion that they needed to be. So we came here, we both looked at each other and said, gee, this reminds us of Boston and Philadelphia. So this could, healthcare turns out to be a major engine for the economy in both Boston and Philadelphia. So I thought, you know, this could actually work out pretty well, could really get things going here. And truth be told, that's kind of the way things are going right now. So that was kind of intriguing. So that we kind of took up that challenge. Nice place to live, great people, great job opportunity, and a chance to help make Detroit better than it was at the time, and certainly to restore it to its greatness.
If there's a NHL general manager listening tonight, he's probably thinking, wait a minute, this guy's in Boston in the 60s, the Bruins were the kahuna. Then in the 70s, the Flyers were the best. Now he comes here, the Wings are the best. I should move this guy to my city. So,
well, I unfortunately, they won a Stanley Cup beating the Flyers when I was in Philadelphia, so almost, but not quite the analogy there.
You mentioned, Dr. Kelly, that Henry Ford Health System incurs $100 million per year in uncompensated care. Explain that to us.
Well, every hospital does provide some uncompensated care because by federal law, anyone who presents themselves to the emergency room of any hospital must be cared for. And if they need to be admitted, they must be cared for, regardless of whether they can pay or not. So every hospital has some patients that don't pay. Henry Ford Hospital is a very large hospital, over 900 beds. And as we now know, the unemployment rate is extremely high in Detroit, getting close to 30%. And it's always been high in recent memory anyway. It's been a depressed city. So we see it as a mission here. We're located in the city, and we are committed to staying here in the city and anchoring the city. So we do have a lot of people who come and seek care in our hospital. The term that's been used is these are safety net hospitals. These are the hospitals that provide the care when nobody else can. And I've only been here a little over 9 years, but a lot of hospitals have left this city because of the migration of the population and some of the very real economic issues that have to be dealt with. Anyway, we do provide in excess of $100 million of real losses in uncompensated care, and it's of concern. Universal coverage is certainly something that we would like to see for obvious reasons, but also for very real reasons that people need some basic form of insurance. But meanwhile, the hospitals in the inner city, it's true in New York, it's true in Philadelphia, it's true in Chicago, true in L.A., have to eat these costs. So we do it, but if this continues to erode the bottom lines of safety net hospitals like us and DMC and others, it will be a real crisis for the hospitals.
Dr. Kelly, what are your thoughts on the current healthcare debate?
Well, as we talked about, Jack, we could cover a couple of hours worth on that one. I'll try to make it real simple. We've talked a little bit about this on Paul W. Show. Let's get down to the basic truths of what's happened right now. We've evolved a, we call a system of care, which is really a non-system of care to the current time. So here are the problems. And these are problems I think that everybody acknowledges. Number one, not everybody has health coverage. And usually to get health care coverage, you have to be employed by somebody who offers it. So that sort of flies in the face. Is health care something that the public supports in general for all people? And that's a matter of principle. We're the only Western country, developed country, that has not basically acknowledged that that's society's role to provide basic coverage for everybody. It's true in England, it's true in Canada, we can come back to that. So that's a major black eye on I think, our values here. The second issue is that healthcare is way too expensive. It's running out of sight. The president has said that it's killing the economy, it's killing companies. It's really lethal in many ways. First, it's lethal to the federal government. Medicare, which is our entitlement for people over the age of 65, will go bankrupt probably by the year 2020 at the current rate of expenditure. So you think we got a problem now with the deficit, it'll run amok by that time. It'll have to be solved independent of any universal coverage issue. The second issue is that the employers are basically providing this cost. I just happened to come across an article just today where for the average worker, given that the family coverage is about $12,000 a year, if you run that up and do the math and so on and look at some of the expenditures that are going on, what it actually costs to provide the care, this particular writer did analysis that it's probably around $1.5 billion of cost per employee that people over their lifetime that the companies are supporting. That's a lot of money. It's a lot of money. The third part that's a problem is that nobody sees that cost except those who have to pay the insurance themselves. So if you're employed and your employer is paying for much of this, there's no price sensitivity. There's been a feeling that there's an entitlement there. And this is a universally held feeling. So you put those all together and it's a perfect storm. Everybody feels healthcare should be a right, but nobody wants to pay for it. That's kind of what this whole debate is all about. So when the president said we need to cover all Americans, everybody said, that's terrific. We all agree with that as a principle. But then when it came down to the Congressional Budget Office actually pricing that out, everybody said, wow, we're going to go broke even faster than if Medicare were killing us. So now all the partisan politics has come out, unfortunately. I think that, that's unfortunate because I think people really wanted to see some genuine coverage here. So where do I think this is going and what's happening? The president's going to have to come out with some compromise. It's probably going to be a watered-down version of many of the issues that have been discussed. And otherwise, it's going to be a political defeat for him. What I fear is that it'll be so watered down that we won't have made any progress. There was some momentum going on here. My own personal view of the strategy is it was too much too fast. They're trying to get universal coverage passed right away, raise some of the usual concerns about the economy, about what was actually affordable and so on. And the real political error that was made was trying to pay for universal coverage for everyone by cutting costs in Medicare. Now, Medicare is too expensive as it is. It needs to have some economic discipline in it. But to tie those two issues together, doing something with Medicare to pay for universal coverage has angered many senior citizens. Because Medicare for them, for many people, Medicare is the best insurance coverage they've ever had in their life, and they have it for life. There's no way the government can cancel that. So now we've got a big problem. AARP members are burning their cards and things like that. And I just saw last night ads by AARP defending their position. So now everybody's trying to defend their position on anything. And I think we've gotten into a situation which is unfortunate and probably going to have to stall a lot of any sort of solutions we're going to have to this problem.
We're talking to Dr. Mark Kelly, and I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Now, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
We're talking to the CEO of the Henry Ford Medical Group, Dr. Mark Kelly. Doctor, the Henry Ford Medical Group employs its doctors. It's the only healthcare system in the Detroit metro area that does so. Why?
The reason, Jack, is because of Henry Ford himself. Henry Ford founded the Henry Ford Hospital in 1915. And he founded it as a charitable organization to support Detroit. Some pundits have said that he actually founded it so he could serve his auto workers, but those two things go hand in hand. But being the industrial genius he was, he knew nothing about health care. And so he actually had a conversation with the Mayo brothers at a social event and said, the famous quote is, I've got myself a hospital, now how do I run it? And what the Mayo brothers, who had been, they and their father had been in practice by that time, probably about 25 years, something like that. Their recommendation was, first of all, you should have a group practice. You should have doctors who are all under one umbrella. And Henry Ford decided that the hospital should employ the doctors. And he said that the Mayo brothers also said, there's this new hospital in Baltimore that looks like it's doing some great things. It's called the Johns Hopkins Hospital. And so Henry Ford made some inquiries there, and the first two chiefs of surgery and medicine, respectively, were recruited from the Hopkins Hospital. Johns Hopkins was the first teaching institution that devoted itself completely to the training of young doctors. There had been sort of apprenticeships that had gone on in other hospitals for many years, but they really had that model down. So the so-called teaching hospital really began with Johns Hopkins. So Henry Ford Hospital is really one of the first, maybe the first, actually, hospital to employ its doctors. This was not a popular notion at the time. It was considered to be very much of an industrial model. I'm told that the doctors who did join the hospital, were employed by it, were kicked off the Wayne County Medical Society because of that. Anyway, that proved the beginnings of our group, and it's persisted the current time. The doctors were all there to work on the patient. One of the things that Henry Ford believed in is that whenever a patient came in, not only did you treat what their ailment was that they complained about, but you, as he would with a car, checked under the hood and checked everything else. So everybody got a thorough workup and came out, out the door, presumably restored to health. So that's been our model now for 100 years. And we're one of the first big group practices. There are three big group practices in the United States that have medical education and research at their core: Mayo Clinic, ourselves, and the Cleveland Clinic. Those are the three big, we call, academic group practices in the country. And we're 1,200 physicians, as you pointed out. Mayo is about twice as large as we are because they have other locations across the country, and Cleveland Clinic is somewhat bigger than we are. But that's our model.
When we were young, the general physician used to come to the house when we got sick. But also, I never heard the word cancer. And today, doctor, young women, 25, 30, 35 years old, they have cancer. Why?
Well, they had cancer then, too. Cancer was, speaking of cancer itself, some forms of cancer in the early part of the 20th century are actually pretty rare. And some cancer was not diagnosed until the patient died. Our diagnostic testing right now is quite good at usually picking up early cancer. So a lot of what physicians did in the first part of the last century was kind of look at the patient, evaluate. They didn't, and had to use their own senses, meaning listening and listening to the patient's story and listening to the heart and things like that, to make the diagnosis. The epidemiology of cancer is more apparent now because people live longer. Cancer occurs mostly in older people, not young people. We do have, as you say, young women who are affected by cancer, young men too. Those are relatively unusual, and these are the people who, frankly, just died in the old days. But cancer affects more common the older people, and life expectancy has gone up. I mean, we're up in the high 70s and low 80s now for the average person, and that's when cancer tends to be more common. So I think what we're seeing in terms of the, quote, cancer epidemic is much to do with that. Yes, there are environmental issues. For example, I mentioned that lung cancer, until there was smoking in the early part of the 20th century, was considered a rare disease. Now it's among the most common cancers, fortunately going down somewhat in men at least. So I think it's detection. I think it's the fact that we're living longer that we see more cancer now.
Will we find a cure for cancer?
Well, we've cured some cancers already. There's no question about that. Some of the childhood cancers have been cured. Cancer called lymphoma, cancer of lymph glands, in many cases highly curable. Breast cancer in early stages, highly curable. Prostate cancer. So yes, we can cure cancer. But the trick to the whole thing is detecting it early now. The big question now is if the tumor has spread more widely, can we cure that? We can't. There are some cancers that we have advanced therapies where people who have fairly widespread disease can also be cured. So I think we're going to have this more under control. I think the question is, are we able to detect it so early that you can insert a gene or something and the cancer will never occur? Perhaps. I mean, the things that we're doing now for patients, we're unthinkable. Bone marrow transplant. I mean, who would have thought that we could have done that? And that cures leukemia and some other cancers as well. So I think the technology is going to be there. But, Jack, you know, life is a terminal illness. We can't be everybody's searching for the holy grail of immortality here, and that's just not going to happen. The biggest problem right now is as I like to say, we're all rusting real fast. So you can have somebody who's perfectly healthy in terms of their body, and they have dementia, have Alzheimer's. That's going to be the biggest problem, I think, once we get through some of these other cures, as you say, is the aging process.
Many people today, Doctor, are stressed, confused, depressed. They're scared. What should they do?
Well, they're scared about a lot of things. Lots to be scared about these days, and particularly in our Michigan economy and Detroit region. I think people are. I see patients, so I talk to them. I think most people are coping. I think this is a very, in my view, a very family-oriented community we have here. I think people take solace in their families, and I think in some of the simple things in life that matter. In the healthcare business, one of the things that really matters is whether you're healthy or not. I think that as they say, wealth is nice, but health is true richness, is true wealth. And so I think that getting back to the simple things is important. And also, I think that the perspective that things will get better, they always have, they always will. And I think people here in Michigan are very, I found to their credit, very tenacious. They're going to get through this. They're very doggedly determined to this. And I think, at least in my circles, and I see patients and everything else, people are still upbeat. There hasn't been a lot of the tension that you might see otherwise in this type of situation. So I think people are depressed. I think they are concerned, and I'm certainly not at all negating some of the very serious issues that people have. But I've been actually very impressed with how stoic people have been here. And I think it's a sense of family, a sense that maybe we went too far. You know, we all had a good ride during the upbeat of the economy, and that was everywhere, not just here. And now there's sort of a movement to the center, something that the pendulum is swinging the other way. So I think people see that and probably have a longer perspective in mind.
We're talking to Dr. Mark Kelly, who was the voice of Harvard hockey while he was a student. And I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Anything is possible with Jack Crisula on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with the good doctor, Dr. Mark Kelly. Doctor, if you could give our listeners this evening two thoughts, only two thoughts, what would they be?
Well, I think the first one I would say is that a lot of life is about attitude. I think you can control a lot of how you feel about things by how you react to them. And I think a positive attitude is very important. I'm a glass half full guy, maybe fuller than that. Jack, you're a super full guy, and that makes a lot of difference. If you, as one of my colleagues said at Penn, elderly, very distinguished gentleman, he said, you know, if you wake up in the morning and you get in the upright position, which not all people can, and you know who you are and where you are, that's a good start. And I think you got to value each day. We never know how many days we're given. So I think positive attitude is good. The second is always face facts. Always face facts. And don't delude yourself as to what's going on. That doesn't mean you fear the truth, but the truth is the truth. It is what it is. And I think I'm an intensive care physician by background. We face facts with families. We face facts with patients. And I think that's always it's a straight shot into what the reality is. And then you deal with it. So you deal with things and try to fix them as best you can and move on and try to do with a happy attitude and a can-do attitude.
About a month ago, we had Ken Matzik, the CEO of Beaumont here, with this full head of hair. You come in here tonight, full head of hair. John Marshall, our producer, and I, no hair. Do you guys have some secret pill in that pharmacy in these hospitals?
Well, I don't know what Ken has. Maybe he's a 104 patient. We have a secret pill. I don't know, but Jack, we can work on you guys anytime. You'll just have to come and visit us.
Uncompensated care or no?
We can work something out. We always work something out for people to see how they can pay.
You love, Dr. Kelly, to use sports anecdotes. Why?
Well, I like sports. That's nothing new in this town in Detroit or any of the ones I've been in. And I've been an athlete. I was never a star athlete. But I think sports are terrific in terms of teaching lessons, I believe. I think we sometimes get a little too excited about them. But sports has a beginning and end. There are rules. Performance matters in sports. And you learn to take your lumps and you learn to celebrate your victories. So it's somewhat of a metaphor for life, kind of like golf, Jack. We talked about that. That's another metaphor for life. But I use the analogies because a lot of people get that. They get the analogies. They understand the value of teamwork, of preparation, of responding to things you didn't expect, and setbacks that have to be dealt with, but that don't defeat you permanently. So I use those, and as I said, when you use those metaphors, most people get it, and you don't have to explain much thereafter. So I think it's a good message, and certainly one that works in Michigan.
In being a doctor for 36 years, you've seen a lot of death. What has being a doctor taught you about death?
Well, I think our mortality is very sobering. I think in as again, I'm an intensive care physician, so I tend to see the worst of the worst, and tragically so in many cases, sudden events. Somebody was healthy and a setback occurred, and unfortunately sometimes patient succumbs to that. I think you appreciate the fragility of life. One of the issues that we deal with as physicians is we're not perfect by any means. And I'm not talking about medical errors. I just mean there are only so many things that we can do. Not to say we don't make mistakes too. We do, but that despite everybody's efforts and medical science, that nature has its own way of doing things. So I think it sobers you about the perspective of life and death. I think most physicians have that perspective. They've seen it so many times. I think you also, one thing that I really take home is that how heroic most patients are. I don't mean that in any manner of speaking, but just that they are able to face this adversity. It happens very consistently. The people really can face the reality of their mortality. It takes time to do that, but I've been very impressed with the courage and the commitment that people have had, and especially their own concern about their family members who are trying to hover over them at this mortal moment. So that's been very inspiring about how people cope with those sorts of things. It shows you the tenacity and the courage of the human spirit.
Dr. Kelly, earlier you talked about attitude and the value of attitude. Talk to us also about the power of laughter in healing.
Well, that's actually very important. I think that there's a fine line in that. I think that patients, in my own experience, I like to use a sort of a lighthearted touch. That may sound a little weird for an intensive care physician. I don't tend to be lighthearted in the ICU, but I see patients in the office in my pulmonary practice, my lung disease practice. I think it's useful to be able to engage the patients, particularly when you don't know them, in a sort of a casual, friendly way to get to know them, maybe talk a little bit, interact as you would in a social setting, so that they feel more comfortable with you as a person. And then the time comes to get down to brass tacks and say, okay, now we're going to talk about kind of what's going on, what we're going to do about it, and so on. And that transition from engaging the patient on very human levels, often with humor, and then moving into the more serious discussion, for me personally, has worked very well. That doesn't mean we joke around a lot when things are serious, but I think when you do bring a balanced approach that's not 100% somber to the conversation, patients reflect on that a little bit and say, well, I guess I'm taking this in the perspective of everything else in my life, my family, what I like to do, who I am, and so on. And things get a little more sober. I should say balanced, and not sober, but balanced in terms of people's perspectives. So I think that, again, having a positive attitude is is very important to the doctor-patient relationship.
On the one hand, today we've got more technology than ever. We know more about good foods than ever, but obesity is an ever-growing problem. What's the answer?
Well, there's been a lot written about that lately. It's some people have blamed this on genetics. It's not that. I think that we have the same gene pool that we had, not exactly the same, but very similar gene pool as we've had for many, many years. It's probably a combination of things, Jack. One is that that unhealthy food is a lot cheaper than healthy food now. There's mass production of fast foods and so on. Secondly, people aren't getting enough exercise now. And I also think that people, that kids in particular, reflect off what their parents do. If the parents are not fit or not just serving them a good diet, why would the children do that? So I think there's a lot of habits we've gotten into. Fast food may be a product of the fact they're often two parents working. So what goes on the table is what's the easiest to prepare. So there's a lot of it. I think most of it is a social situation.
Last question, Dr. Mark Kelly. What advice would you give to our young listeners tonight?
I think the best advice I could give is what I gave to my own kids. We're both grown now. They're not kids anymore. Number one, have faith in yourself that you can do things. And number two, and I really believe in this, if you work hard for what you want, and you may not get what you want right away, go for it. And most of the time, you'll be successful. There's time and time, great stories of how people have done it. So tenacity and self-confidence and reality testing, as I said earlier, go hand in hand, and I think you'll find your niche and be successful.
Dr. Mark Kelly, it was a great day when you and Gail moved here. Thanks for all you do for our community.
Thanks, Jack. It was a pleasure to be here.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible.